Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, established in 1894, Casadega is one of Florida's most unique historic communities.
We feel that we are here to have people explore what spirituality is for them. And we feel that there's a difference between religion and spirituality.
We'll discuss Fort Myers in the Civil War.
The reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels.
And we'll talk about Andrew Turnbull and the establishment of New Smyrna Beach. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Created in the late 19th century, the community of Casadega is located about 3/4 of a mile south of Lake Helen and 6 miles from DeLand. Casadega was originally intended to be the winter residence for spiritualists from Lilydale, New York. The spiritualists of Casadega were welcomed by residents of Volusia County who believed Casadegans would benefit the local economy. By the early 20th century, spiritualists were living in Casadega year-round. Spiritualists believe in an infinite intelligence, hands-on healing, and direct communication with the spirit world. In 1880, George P. Colby filed a homestead claim for nearly 75 acres of land in central Florida with the intention of creating a community for spiritualists. In 1894, he established Casadega. In January 1895, Colby gave a warranty deed of 35 acres to the Southern Casadega Spiritualist Camp Meeting Association, the organization that still governs life in Casadega. Jody Martinez is a certified medium, healer, and teacher in Casadega.
George Colby, originally he was born in upstate New York, and then his family moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota. When he was 12 years old, after they moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota, they were actually Unitarians when they were in upstate New York. But when they moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota, the whole town was Baptist. So it was known in that town on the 12th birthday that they would do a baptism. And what they did is they did it in the lake. But since he was born in January of 1848, and when he was 12 years old, when they did the baptism, they put them in the lake when it was frozen. But they left him in a little too long, his heart stopped, and he was seen to the other side. At that point, he was able to connect with his Native American guide, Seneca, and he was able to talk to an uncle that he had in spirit. And at that point, it changed his whole life.
Richard J. Russell is also a certified medium, healer, and teacher in Casadega.
He was in a seance in Iowa, and he had a Indian spirit guide named Seneca. And during the seance, Seneca came through to him and said, "You are supposed to start a spiritual center in the southeastern part of the United States." So being a good spiritualist, he follows his guide. And the next spring, he gathered a couple friends and boarded a train to Chicago from Iowa. And from there, they boarded a train to Jacksonville, Florida. And from there, he boarded a steamboat and came down the St. John's River. And evidently, he was told to get off at Blue Springs Landing, and which is a very famous spring here in Florida.
His guide, Seneca, explained to him that he should come south and start a spiritualist camp.
The Reverend Dr. Lewis Gates is former pastor at Colby Memorial Temple in Casadega.
Well, George Colby started here when he came down. He started up at Jacksonville, came all the way to Blue Springs Landing, got off, and then walked most of the way all the way here, and he found Casadega. That was through his guide, Seneca. And a lot of people don't know this guy, Seneca, the guide, the unknown, and the philosopher. There were three guides that were actually with George Colby as he came into the organization. And he found this property, and just before it was supposed to be getting by somebody else, he got a mule and he went to Gainesville, I think it was Gainesville at that point, and had to go ahead and sign the deed and quitclaim deed for this property.
Anita Evans is a certified medium and owner of the 1928 Joseph Snipes House in Casadega.
He came to Central Florida, his spirit guide, Seneca, touched in with him at the time and told him that he was going to be forming a spiritualist camp in Florida. And he needed to come here basically because he also had consumption, tuberculosis, and he would find property here that had a spring and that he would drink that water and that water would cure him, which it did.
The Spiritualist Association from Lilydale, New York, visited many Central Florida towns in search of a suitable winter residence before deciding on Casadega. De Leon Springs was a leading contender as a site for a spiritualist community, and St. Petersburg, Tampa, Tarpon Springs, St. Augustine, Daytona, and New Smyrna were among other sites that were considered. Eventually, George P. Colby's donated land became the Casadega community. People can own their own homes here, but the Southern Casadega Spiritualist Camp Meeting Association owns the property on which they sit. Anita Evans.
It was donated by Mr. Colby to only and ever be a spiritualist camp. And so you could come here and you could build a house, or you can be a member and buy a house. The house would be yours, but the land would forever belong to the spiritualist camp.
The community of Casadega is designated as an historic district listed in the National Register of Historic Places. Richard Russell.
The two apartment buildings, Harmony Hall and Brigham Hall, are some of the oldest buildings surviving. We lost a lot of wooden houses and structures to fires over the years. In fact, George Colby's home was burned in the 60s. Harmony and Brigham were somewhere like 1898 or something like that. My house is right next to Harmony Hall. It was built in 1906. It's a three-story Victorian, and it's got the carving on the tree. That's from a spirit within the house that passed away, a little girl at 7 1/2.
At the entrance to Casadega is the Casadega Hotel, privately owned for nearly a century. Across the street from the hotel is the Andrew Jackson Davis Building, constructed in 1905. This building is now the Welcome Center and Casadega Bookstore, where visitors can schedule individual readings with resident mediums. Jody Martinez.
They built the hotel at one point, which back then was owned by the camp. And it was a three-story wooden structure, and there's one just like it, the old hotel, that stands in Lilydale to this day. It's identical to that. And then we had what we call now the Andrew Jackson Davis Hall and the camp bookstore. Back then, it was a barn-like structure, and then it turned into a building. And it wasn't until 1905 when it became a true building.
The Colby Memorial Temple was the first building constructed in Casadega in 1895. It was remodeled in 1918, but the building was torn down and replaced with a new temple in 1923. That building remains the centerpiece of the community. Reverend Deborah Ganberg and Reverend Dr. Sheldon Ganberg are co-pastors at Colby Memorial Temple.
A lot of people come here for healing. That's what draws them here, either healing through visiting a medium and having a message from a loved one, or just hands-on healing through spiritualist healing. And so we offer that in Colby Temple every Sunday during our services at our Wednesday evening night service, we offer the healing as well. So some people actually come for just the healing on Wednesday nights and not the message service. So Colby Memorial Temple is very important in that regard.
One of the beautiful things about Colby Temple is that we really try to create a safe place for people to come of all faiths and all religions. We don't have any particular dogma that we follow here. We feel that we are here to have people explore what spirituality is for them. And we feel that there's a difference between religion and spirituality. And if I was to coin us as a temple, we support people in finding out what God is for them. And we try to create a place where different perspectives are offered so people can figure it out for themselves.
Casadega is one of Florida's most unique historic communities. For more information, watch episode 63 of our Florida Frontiers television series about Casadega. Check your local PBS schedule, find it online at myfloridahistory.org, and on the Florida Historical Society YouTube channel. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books about Florida history and culture, watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. MyFloridaHistory.org is also where you can register for the 2026 Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, being held May 28th through 30th at the Shores Resort and Spa, right on Daytona Beach. We'll be recognizing the 150th anniversary of the incorporation of Daytona with engaging presentations and panel discussions from professional historians, authors, educators, and students. We'll be taking tours of historic sites, including the Mary McLeod Bethune House and the Ponce Inlet Lighthouse, the Halifax Historical Museum, and the Casements. Our banquet speaker will be Chris Lamb, author of the book Blackout, The Untold Story of Jackie Robinson's First Spring Training. The annual FHS Awards Luncheon is also part of the event. Registration for the 2026 Florida Historical Society Public History Forum is at myfloridahistory.org. That's also where you can get our special conference rate at the Shores Resort and Spa. I'll be there in Daytona May 28th through 30th, and I hope to see you there too. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, as the third state to secede, Florida was an eager supporter of the Confederacy and contributed a number of men to the Southern Army, but it was not the site of many major battles.
That's correct, but Florida did play an important role in the Civil War, especially after the U.S. cut off access to the cattle-raising regions of the Trans-Mississippi. Late in the war, as the movement of cattle from Florida to Georgia became critical to feeding Southern troops, Florida's importance rose. Union strategists hoped to cut off access to beef by focusing on two areas, one in the northern part of the peninsula and one in the southwestern region. The Southwestern Initiative centered on Fort Myers, a Seminole War installation that had been abandoned in 1858. As Irvin D. Solomon in his 1993 article, Southern Extremities, The Significance of Fort Myers in the Civil War, argued, the reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels. First, Although Confederates had become accustomed to the federal embargo and its enforcement by the Union East Gulf blockading squadron, as well as the periodic raids along the West Coast, they were less willing to tolerate a permanent federal post in South Florida. They understood that the presence of the U.S. soldiers represented a serious threat to the cattlemen supplying the Confederate armies. Finally, and perhaps equally important, the Union commanders decided to staff the fort with soldiers from the U.S. colored troops.
By 1864, South Florida, like many parts of the Confederacy, was awash with competing views on the war, and loyalties were not as clear-cut as they had been 3 years earlier.
That's right. Many South Floridians were willing to serve in the Home Guard, but resisted conscription to fight in Georgia and Virginia. Indeed, Solomon notes that General P.G.T. Beauregard, commander of the military department in South Florida, and Florida Governor John Milton issued conditional pardons to those who had evaded conscript officers in the hopes of wooing them back to the cause. So you had the U.S. military seeing an opportunity to cut off the food supply to the Confederate Army, a small Confederate military presence determined to protect the supply lines, and a large group of farmers and cattlemen vacillating between the two forces. Finally, there were those black soldiers, the Confederates' worst nightmare, armed blacks in the very heart of South Florida. Solomon reports that Union commanders, quote, often vacillated on the issue of emancipation, but the presence of black troops encouraged self-emancipation by area slaves. As one Confederate observer noted, events changed after the placement of U.S. colored troops at Fort Myers. Quote, it was a war for possession of this country. The federal troops, mostly Negroes, made a move to go through the country to burn, destroy, and capture everything from Fort Myers, end quote.
Connie, this conflict between opposing armies over production and movement of cattle transformed into a larger ideological and cultural conflict, right?
Indeed it did, and it often pitted people against one another on the same side. The presence of the Union Army encouraged refugees to seek safety in the fort, but Unionists were frequently appalled by the presence of black troops, who also tried to protect men and women escaping slavery. In what quickly became overcrowded conditions, the tensions were high at Fort Myers. For their part, the Confederates created the Florida Special Cavalry, or Cow Cavalry, to, quote, repulse the now frequent Union forays, protect Confederate cattle herds, and stem the rising tide of desertion, end quote. Things came to a head in the winter of 1865, when the Confederates, under the command of Major William Footman and a force of 275 men, marched out of Tampa, planning a surprise attack in the late evening or early morning. On February 20, 1865, the Confederate forces confronted the troops at Fort Myers. Although the Confederates had the troops and armament superiority, they withdrew after 11 hours and returned to Fort Meade. An eyewitness reporter from the New York Times wrote that, quote, the colored troops were in the thickest of the bite. Their impetuosity could hardly be restrained. They seemed totally unconscious of danger, or regardless of it, and their constant cry was to get at them, unquote. On March 14, 1865, the U.S. Army completed a planned withdrawal from Fort Myers, providing the Confederates with reason to claim victory long after they left the field of battle. While Solomon recognizes the engagement at Fort Myers did not change the outcome of the war or even count as one of the more memorable battles, the history of Fort Myers, quote, affirmed the Union's ability to disrupt Confederate activity throughout South Florida's interior, confirming the validity of the federal strategy of blockading the coast, raiding the hinterland, and interdicting the critical cattle trade in South Florida, contributing to the decline of the Confederacy and its ultimate defeat, end quote.
An often overlooked part of the Civil War in Florida. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is professor of history at the University of Central Florida, director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Scotsman Andrew Turnbull established the colony of New Smyrna in 1767. Remnants of the foundation of a coquina building that Turnbull was constructing was originally thought to be the ruins of a Spanish fort, but was actually from Florida's British period. Sebastian Garcia has more about Andrew Turnbull's New Smyrna colony.
Rachel Williams serves as a historian for the Orange County Regional History Center. She recently wrote about the initial British settlement of New Smyrna in the late 18th century. In 1763, the British acquired Florida as a result of their victory in the Seven Years' War. The British began offering land to settlers as a way to capitalize on their newly acquired territory. Individuals like Dr. Andrew Turnbull saw an opportunity and took the offer.
Turnbull was a Scottish man. He was like a pharmacist because he later had an apothecary before he eventually died. But he wanted to settle in East Florida because at the time, Britain was offering land for those that would settle, clear the land, and start growing crops and starting to make money for the crown. So he took advantage of that. He got 20,000 acres. And then eventually he partnered with two other people to have then 60,000 acres for the settlement.
Turnbull named his 60,000-acre settlement New Smyrna after a port city in the Ottoman Empire that was called Smyrna.
He was a consul of the Ottoman Empire at the time, and his wife was from a place in the Ottoman Empire called Smyrna. Today, it's modern day, I think it's pronounced Izmir in Turkey, but he apparently seemed to really like that town of Smyrna, and also Smyrna being his wife's hometown, he wanted to name his new settlement after that.
Such Mediterranean connections also inspired Turnbull's recruitment strategy to populate New Smyrna.
Because of, you know, the time that he did spend there, he saw specifically with Greek people, he saw like a work ethic that he really liked and wanted primarily to recruit Greeks, but ended up mostly recruiting Minorcans, which is a very small island in the Mediterranean, as well as some Corsican Greeks and some Italians as well. So he was trying to incentivize people to come to this new land. He promised that he would give some of that land in exchange for several years of work to further incentivize people to come work for him and help settle this land in Florida.
These incentives fell short almost immediately, as about a month after their arrival, the recruited settlers revolted.
People got there and realized that it was not all that he had promised. They were in charge of clearing this land that they were not familiar with. There was disease there that they weren't exposed to and were getting very sick, but still expected to work. So they revolted. It's primarily led by the Italians, and some even tried to flee to Cuba, but they were captured. I think someone died in the conflict of it all, for which two of the settlers were held accountable and were killed for that. But overall, not very good conditions, and it continued to get worse. They had to ration food, and apparently, according to settlers' accounts, they were not allowed to fish.
Conditions worsened after the revolt, as nearly half of the 1,200 settlers who left their homeland in 1768 died by 1769.
Around 1,200 settlers that got there in 1768. By 1769, nearly half of those settlers had died from malnutrition and disease. While they had some decent harvests, specifically for indigo, by the mid-1770s, the soil had been depleted of its nutrients just because of how intensely they were farming the land. And then couple that with droughts as well, they weren't getting the harvests that they had anticipated, and they weren't making the money anymore. So everything was just kind of compounding on itself, which just further drove the settlement into chaos and ultimately failure.
Almost a decade later, in 1777, a majority of the remaining settlers abandoned the area and relocated to St. Augustine, accepting a sympathetic offer from the governor of East Florida, who harbored political animosity towards Turnbull.
1776, Turnbull's in England working, so three settlers walked from New Smyrna to St. Augustine to speak with the governor of East Florida and basically file their grievances. And at the time, the governor, Patrick Tonyan, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, T-O-N-Y-N, he was a political adversary of Turnbull, so he was very sympathetic to these settlers and ended up canceling their work contracts, because even at the time, there was rumors that they weren't even going to get the land, that their work contracts weren't going to be honored. So by 1777, about 600 of those settlers ended up relocating to St. Augustine, although some did stay behind in the hopes of getting that land, which in 1783, when Spain eventually did regain Florida following the Treaty of Paris, Spain did grant land to the remaining settlers in New Smyrna. And there are still some descendants of those settlers in both New Smyrna and in St. Augustine for those that relocated.
In addition to living descendants, remnants from Turnbull's failed settlement remain in New Smyrna today. Pass by North Riverside Drive and Washington Street, and you'll find coquina ruins dating back to the 18th century British settlement.
It is just a foundation made out of coquina. When you see it, you might not really know what you're looking at. It just kind of looks like a strange stone structure, kind of with like an interesting pattern of holes within the coquina, because it is a foundation of something. We just don't really know what. Some believe that it is like a warehouse foundation or a church foundation or the foundation for a manor that was being built. And we're not even really sure if it ever was completed and then that's just what remains, or if it was just stopped in the middle of its building. So there's a lot that's not known about it, but it does still exist.
When I asked Rachel why we should remember this history, she responded with the following.
New Smyrna isn't the only place in Florida that was built, even though this particular settlement failed. It was built initially by foreign labor. We see that in a lot of places in Florida. And I think that it's important for us to remember that immigrants are the ones that made Florida and made this country. And New Smyrna is just one example of that.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week, and until then, visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. That's where you can also register for the 2026 Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, taking place May 28th through 30th at the Shores Resort and Spa in Daytona Beach. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.